Machiavelli has said that most princes will be tyrants because they too are irrational, men of passion, and so forth. But then he does talk about a virtuous prince. And this is, I want you to catch this. This is crucial. When Machiavelli talks about a virtuous prince, though, he's not now going back to this idealistic. Well, he says, I know most princes will be tyrants, but this is what would be better, if they would be nice guys and get along and they'd be virtuous. No, for him to be a virtuous prince means to exercise your power more shrewdly and ruthlessly than the kind of crude power politics of the tyrant. The shrewd prince is the one who can get the state to serve his interests without turning them into rebels. Okay, so there's going to be a kind of sophistication of power politics now. Machiavelli says, yeah, you've got to have a ruthless prince, no doubt about that. But because of the ruthlessness and crudeness of most princes, what will happen is people will want to rise up against them. So, if you want to be a virtuous prince, that is, if you really want to get your way and be efficient in power politics, then here's advice for how you can be completely in control but not foment rebellion among your people. Does this cynicism scare you? It should. The virtuous prince is not the one who says, I don't want to be a tyrant, you know, because that's not a nice way to rule people. He's the man who says, yes, I want to be a tyrant, but I don't want it to appear that I'm being a tyrant. Because then the people will try to resist my will. And what do I want? I want my will to be dominant. And so by virtue, what Machiavelli means is not ethical value. Virtue is maintaining your power and getting your way. According to Machiavelli, there's not a realm of justice or ethical norms above the state by which the actions of the state must be justified. For him, there's no question about transcendent justice. There's only a question about what do men seek for and what can they do to produce what they are seeking. Are those normative questions? Are those ethical questions? What do men seek after and what can they do to attain it? No, those are factual questions. He doesn't ask what should men seek. He says, what do they seek? Well, they seek power. They're ambitious. Now, the only other question is, and how can they achieve it? How will they be able to gain the power that they seek? And so politics becomes a factual study of means to ends. It is not a study of how you bring the realm of justice into the realm of temporal relations and the power of the state. Now, what are the two principal instruments that are at the disposal of the ruthless prince who would be virtuous, that is, the man who would get his way? They are force and propaganda. Machiavelli says, when the prince must use force, he must employ it ruthlessly. Because it is far better to be feared than to be loved. If you want to be efficient as a politician and you have to choose between having the people love you and fear you, have them love you. I mean, fear you. Because if they love you, they can stop loving you. When they don't get the things they want, they'll stop loving you. But if they fear you, it will make no difference whether you give them what they want. The fear will continue. Isn't that amazing? And, of course, our power politicians today should learn that, because our power politicians today, if anything, are wimps, aren't they? And I'm not talking about just Democrats, Republicans, too. Those politicians that cater to the population wanting to be loved and respected because of the pork barrel and the things we bring you and so forth, they don't realize that when you gain loyalty through that kind of devotion, it's fickle. People will go to the next person who loves them, and they love in return because of what they get. Machiavelli said, forget that. Have the people fear you. So when you have to use power, use it ruthlessly. He said, it will be better if you use it in a concentrated way. You know, don't dish out a little bit here and then next month a little bit and then next year and so forth and always have to be at it. He said, if you come down really hard at the beginning of your reign, then you get a reputation and you won't have to be using that power so much later. Now, whether you agree or disagree with this as a factual assessment, the thing that ought to chill you is that this is a consideration of political philosophy, how to get what you want. Be ruthless in the exercise of power. Force is indispensable, but when you can get your way without force, it is better because the use of force is very expensive. You're going to have to call out the army and so forth and so on. If you would be a shrewd prince, he says, learn to use propaganda to win people over to your side. In a particular, Machiavelli says, learn to persuade people that you're devoted to what they want, even though you're not making any real concession to them at all. Now, I wasn't reading the evening news for this week, my friends. That is Machiavelli from back in the 1500s. Isn't that incredible? Learn through propaganda. Put the right spin on things so that people think you're giving them what they want when in fact you haven't substantially conceded anything to their interest. He did recognize that not everyone will be duped. There always will be the Rush Limbaughs of this world who, you know, want to poke a finger in the eye of these politicians. And so he said propaganda must always be backed up by force. You have to deal very viciously with those who will not be duped. Now, of those ways of the various kinds of propaganda, Machiavelli said the most valuable of all is religion. So when you see Machiavelli talking about religion, he's not talking about the values, the absolute will of God, the justice that is brought to bear in temporal relationships. He's only talking about religion as a social phenomena that can be manipulated for the ruler to get his way. And so the new political ideal of the Renaissance, as we see it, I think, in its classic expression in Machiavelli, is a naturalistic study of the facts with a means to end interest. Not in bringing justice into temporal affairs, but in simply accomplishing the ends of the state. Nationalism, the independence of the temporal power from the church in Dante, the supremacy of the temporal power in Marsiglio, the sovereignty, the uniform administration of one jurisdiction in Bodine, and in Machiavelli, a completely naturalistic understanding of power politics. The irony is that the literature of the Renaissance on political affairs also tends to be utopian. And after we take a short break here, we'll come back and look at Thomas More, Francis Bacon, Thomas Campanella, and Hobbes, and particular theses having to do with the political order that are classically, or if you will, essentially Renaissance in their outlook. All right, let's round out our discussion of Renaissance political theory by looking at our textbook, Sahakian's History of Philosophy, at page 121, where he begins a discussion of the social and political philosophy of the Renaissance. Sahakian discusses five particular works that you should be familiar with if you're going to know something about the Renaissance political scene and also do well on your exam with me. He begins with Machiavelli, whom we were just considering before our break, on page 121, where he describes the work of the prince as a practical guide to unscrupulous rulers. Unscrupulous here, remember, however, should not be taken as a criticism of them from a Machiavellian standpoint. He said there is no question of justice, just the question of achieving what you want. And what you must be interested in political theory is the means to end analysis of how to get your way if you're a ruler. I think you'll enjoy the little summary that he gives you, supplementing what I've told you. I'm not sure that I can add anything more than what you'll get in the reading. He says that the ruler is to make promises to people, but it's really not important whether he keeps them. You make promises to make them happy. Boy, if that doesn't remind you of the political scene of our own day, I don't know what we'll do. You say whatever you want before the election, and afterwards you say, well, I guess it's just not possible to do. And the thing that is interesting to me, this is an aside, is that people put up with that. You know, they get lied to, and then they get lied to, and then they get lied to, and they never ever wake up that maybe we ought to start looking at the lies to see what they really are able to perform and not just listen to it as a promise. But it doesn't work. So was Machiavelli right? He said, people are stupid. They're irrational. Manipulate them. Sadly, from a Calvinistic standpoint, we have an explanation of that. People are depraved. Their stupidity is tied to their selfish lust and desires. But then, of course, as Calvinists, we don't believe that the answer is to get political rulers who know how to manipulate the selfishness of people. But rather, we need political rulers who will bring God's point of view, the way of justice, if you will, into the affairs of the estate, of the state. Did you notice the date for the prince? 1513. In 20 years, roughly, Calvin will publish his Institutes of the Christian Religion as a political treatise to the King of France. And we're going to look at Calvin more tomorrow, but please remember that. When Calvin wrote the Institutes, which eventually grew into basically a systematic theology, the original presentation of theology in a much shorter version of what we now call the Institutes was particularly an appeal to the King of France. And so he has to say something about the proper rule of the king, not just in persecuting the Protestants or not doing so, but also what the place of the state is. It would be a valuable study. I don't know how many of you will pick up a professor's recommendation when your grade's not tied to it. But if you want to be mature scholars, I would suggest that you read The Prince and then read Calvin's discussion of politics. What a difference. Two different ways we go. And it will help you understand why today those who are more in line with the Calvin approach, people like Dr. Bonson, who would like to see that more enunciated in our day, are completely out of step with a culture that has actually taken the way of Machiavelli. Okay, let's move on. Page 123 in your textbook. Well, remember, the first work, if I ask you for the five major political treatises of the Renaissance, you're going to mention Machiavelli's The Prince. Secondly, Sir Thomas More, who was an English philosopher, in 1518 wrote the work, the famous work entitled Utopia. You all know what Utopia literally means? No place. Topos in Greek means place. Utopia means that which is without a place, the no place land. So More is admitting that he's writing about a political order that is, it's not in actuality. It doesn't now exist, but it's the ideal toward which he thinks we should move. And so this is where we get the language of utopian politics. Was Machiavelli utopian? He was ruthless. It's means to end, it's scientific, it's naturalistic. Moore, on the other hand, is completely idealistic. He's utopian. He wrote the book, Utopia. Okay, what characterizes this no place land that his novel talks about? Well, it was communistic. Okay, no private property. Clothing is uniform. No one is idle throughout the day. The society is patriarchal. In order to maintain peace, mercenaries are hired. Only slaves carry on violent occupations. In order to avoid executing criminals, they are given the choice of wandering in exile. And in a utopian world, war is justified only to defend your homeland, to liberate an ally, or to emancipate an oppressed people from tyranny. I would like to point out that the crusading idea that you may use warfare to emancipate people from tyranny is utopian. You go home and let that one sink in. God did not call states to be saviors. He called them to be policemen over their own people. Nevertheless, in Moore's Utopia, a variety of religions would be allowed to be practiced. Atheists would be denied citizenship, but Christianity would not be the one and only religion. We move ahead to Francis Bacon, another utopian work, A New Vision for a New Society. And the ideal life that is portrayed by Francis Bacon in 1623 is the work The New Atlantis. Now, Francis Bacon, as we will see in a few moments, is a leader in the scientific revolution and empirical spirit of the Renaissance. And so it will not surprise you, I trust, that the New Atlantis, this ideal society according to Bacon, is inhabited by people who seek increased productivity through scientific advances. This is, I mean, it's not fair to call it the technological society, but it's the society that has all the latest scientific insights and inventions and so forth. Why will the people of the New Atlantis engage in trade and contact with foreigners so that they can spread the enlightenment of science to them? And though communism of goods was of interest, the most important thing on the New Atlantis is a sharing of knowledge. A communism of ideas, if you will. And civilization will reach its apex, will reach its utopian ideal form through science then, through the exercise of man's rational ability in knowing and controlling the natural world. Okay, so you have Machiavelli, power politics, if I can put it very briefly. 1513. Then in 1518, 5 years later, Thomas More's Utopia has communism. Everything's uniform. In 1623, now it's a century later, I realize we're making big jumps here, Francis Bacon has an ideal society, the New Atlantis, that shares scientific advances for the enlightenment and promotion of the world. Also in 1623, a utopian philosopher named Thomas Campanella wrote. He was an Italian patriot, and he wrote a book entitled The City of the Sun. And in the City of the Sun, we find a social order that is completely communistic. No person receives more than he deserves or more than his needs require. And in this City of the Sun that's completely communistic, there will be neither poverty nor wealth. By getting rid of private property and making sure nobody receives more than he needs and everybody gets what he deserves, then everybody will be happy. Why will men work if they don't have the profit motive? They will work out of love for their countrymen. Because we love our country and we know it's for the good of the country, we will all go to work. And we'll all be happy. And who will be the rulers in the City of the Sun? Those who have the best academic education. Here you have Plato's philosopher kings again. There will be no established religion in the City of the Sun, but only a Christian ethic. Listen closely, a Christian ethic. Not the Christian theology. That's not important. What's important is that we all act like Christians. We see that kind of thing in the 20th century where Christianity is liberalized. We no longer will believe the theology of Christianity, but in the first generation of liberalism, we all want to love our neighbors and act like Christians. And then what happens? You come to the 1960s in our country, and you have people will say, well, if you give up Christian theology, you can no longer promote Christian morality either. So let's just get back to nature. Do the Mother Earth thing, you know? Be hippies. I'm serious. You will find, if you study the history of philosophy and the history of culture, and this is just your first taste of it, most of you, but you will find the more you study, you realize history just repeats itself. You have different players in a different setting, different vocabulary, but the basic themes, motivations, and developments are the same over and over again. I have emphasized Thomas Campanella because I want you to realize what, back in, what did we say, 1623, you have a man who is promoting the views of Karl Marx. Okay? 200 years later, when Karl Marx has this revolutionary idea, see, where everybody would receive what he needs and nobody will have more than what he needs, that was already propagated years before that. And then we have one other political treatise, perhaps the most important of all of them, that by Thomas Hobbes in 1651, Leviathan. Let me draw an analogy here. To understand Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, you need to understand that Francis Bacon was a leader in the scientific revolution in England. His view of society was tied to his understanding and development of the methods of science in the natural domain. This was all tied together. Likewise, this is the analogy. If you would understand Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, his view of civil government, you must first understand the other areas of Hobbes' philosophy. And we're going to do that a little bit later in our outline. You'll notice down under Roman numeral 20, I'm going to make an object lesson out of the contrast between Calvin, his understanding of enlightenment in the 1500s, and then Hobbes, who is the foreshadow of the Enlightenment in Europe a century later in his view of Leviathan and particularly his materialistic view of life, his view that everything is matter in motion. So I just want to point out for the purposes of your outline where Leviathan falls. Let me give you a thumbnail sketch of Leviathan. We're going to look at it more later. According to Hobbes, when men live in the state of nature, everybody is insecure. Because though we want certain things, we never know that there isn't going to be a bigger bully on the block who comes along and takes it away from us. Okay? So in the state of nature, there's perpetual competition and no one's at peace. Therefore, what people do, though they are sacrificing some of their freedom, they get together and they make a contract or a covenant with one another, and they say, let's have somebody rule over us to keep us from taking from each other and beating up on each other. And so they sacrifice part of their freedom through their voluntary contract, and they call a political ruler in, and Hobbes called that political ruler Leviathan. You need to understand, I mean, this is wonderful imagery. Leviathan, of course, is a creature, a beast from the Bible, right? And what does the Bible tell us in Revelation 13? The beast would rule over all with authoritarian might. And so Hobbes looks for the beast. He looks for the Leviathan. But this is the Leviathan who is invited to have that kind of dominance for the sake of keeping society lawful and orderly. Throughout Western history, you could see previously, and you will see from this time on, there is the constant temptation of people, even when they are making the choice, to choose authoritarian rulers for the sake of their peace and prosperity. Nazi Germany, perfect illustration. We look back at that and we know the horrors of Hitler. We say, how could people have willfully chosen a man like that? I'll tell you why. For the same reason the Romans were willing to take the Caesars. Because as bad as it is to have rulers like that, you could count on the trains, not in Rome, in Germany, the trains would run on time. And when you earned something, though it was very hard in an oppressive political order to do so, at least it would be yours, and you could count on the fact that the police would move in and keep others from beating up on you. And people will sometimes give up their freedom for a more risk-free society. There's a lesson here. Reflect on this more later. That is Leviathan. That's also the end of my comments on the political ideals of the Renaissance. I'm going to be very, very quick about the last point today. We need to get done. I'd like to look at the scientific spirit of the Renaissance as well, the new empirical spirit that is part of the Renaissance mindset. At the time of the Renaissance, people were developing a lively curiosity about the world in which they lived and wanting to know more about it and how it works. They realized they had to study it. They had to go and have, if you will, eyewitness contact. They had to have firsthand experience of the world. And they also had to be free from the idea of an authority which, in advance of investigation, can tell you what the world must be like and how you relate to it. All of these things we've already seen developing in the general period we call the Renaissance. Curiosity about the world, independence from authority, and a desire for firsthand experience to know things observationally. We see, remember Petrarch's interest in nature. He climbed a mountain. You know, not just because he had to get to the other side, but because it was there, as we say, you know, to savor the experience. We see in Chaucer realistic portrayals of the pilgrims in his account. There was the passion for exploration that we've seen previously. We see in the painters a desire for realism, a study of the effect of light and perspective in paintings. Schaefer will talk about that, and we'll look at it some more tomorrow when we get back together. The rejecting of the authority of the church in the Renaissance revival of learning. Well, what I'm getting at is the things that you already know about the Renaissance very naturally lead to a desire to study the world in a way which we would consider more scientific. Think about Leonardo da Vinci, the Renaissance man par excellence. His date's 1452 to 1519. I've already indicated to you that if I'm dividing up history, I would take the birth of Leonardo, 1450-ish, if you will, as a pretty good bump, because Constantinople has fallen, 1453. Leonardo was born 1452. He died in 1519, which is just 2 years after Luther, you know, nails the 95 Theses. And as you all know, I hope you all know, who could get through high school and not know Leonardo da Vinci? A man of magnificent intellect. Universal genius, as many people would say. There's a great variety of things that he did. Sculpture, architecture, city planning, military engineering, astronomy, botany, geology, mechanics, hydraulics, physical geography, anatomy. He was just a tremendous scholar, curious about the natural world. And he believed that to understand the natural world, you must do experimentation. You must go and examine with your senses. Let me just read one line from him, just to illustrate the empirical spirit. But before you found a law on this case, test it two or three times and see whether the experiments produce the same effects. You take that for granted. People of the Renaissance didn't. He said, if you really want to understand the way the world works, you've got to repeat your experiments. You've got to make sure of your of what you've studied. According to Leonardo, there is a rational structure in the universe. There is a regularity and predictability about it. So if you really do understand the universe, you should be able to experiment two or three times and get the same effects. One must be painstaking in observing the facts. Keep notebooks. Be detailed. Pay attention. Or consider William Gilbert. And the only thing I'm going to point out about him is his famous treatise on magnetic bodies, published in 1600. What's of interest about Gilbert is that this treatise, published in 1600, is just filled with trying to find out the facts for the sake of what the facts are. A curiosity about how do magnets work? And what kind of superstition can experimentation, you know, get rid of? There's a lot of superstitious views of magnets in the Middle Ages. And so he goes out to do experiments, to test things. Well, this is the new spirit of the Renaissance, the scientific revolution. And just think of the kind of the day that Gilbert lived in. He was born in 1544. That's a year after the death of Copernicus, 2 years before Luther's. He himself died in 1603. And in 1603, Kepler, Galileo, and Bacon were all reaching their full maturity. He studied at Cambridge, possibly Oxford. He traveled to Italy. He practiced medicine when he came home. He became the president of the Royal College of Physicians and was a personal physician to Queen Elizabeth. What an age. This man's a very significant man, but he's the Renaissance man with an empirical interest in detailed study and experimentation. Scrupulous interest in the details of first-hand observation and the testing of hypotheses. Francis Bacon, more than these others, was very self-conscious and was a publicist, if you will, for scientific advance. He was a real cheerleader for the importance of science. Now, how could you illustrate that? What did he write? the New Atlantis, and in the New Atlantis, what's great about that society? Scientific advance, the usefulness of science, and the enlightenment it brings. His theme was knowledge is power. Knowledge is power. He thought that Aristotle was fruitless. To try to do science and to follow the authority of Aristotle was ridiculous. You need to get out and study the world, learn to control it, gain power from it. He also was a man who was active in politics in his day. He was a member of parliament in 1584. He was knighted. He was rising steadily in the political arena of England. In 1617, he became Lord Keeper and Chancellor of the Domain. In 1621, he was convicted of taking bribes and lost his reputation. But what I want you to see is this man was very active in politics, rising fast. He wrote literature, The New Atlantis. He was a scientist, and so forth and so on. These were Renaissance men. We haven't seen many like them. What's important about Bacon? He said he was interested in that knowledge whose dignity is maintained by works of utility and power. His main motive for studying the world was power, to get things done. Science is a road to power. Bacon also had quite an overweening pride. He believed that what is called for is a total reconstruction of the sciences, arts, and all human knowledge, what he called the Great Instauration. Everything that had gone before was corrupted by superstition, speculation, and it needed to be cleared away for the new total Instauration. And so he wrote a book entitled Novum Organum, the new instrument of knowledge. The new instrument of knowledge would be beneficial, would be efficient, because it would have cleared away all the superstitions and the intellectual fallacies of past thinkers. The mind would become like a mirror that reflects things truly because it has an even, clean surface. I want you to remember this image of the mind as a mirror that needs to be flattened out and made clear. He also likened it to a piece of paper. Because when we come back and study John Locke, 1690, at the end of this century, Locke will be using the same image. The human mind is a blank sheet of paper, a tabula rasa. But for Bacon, even more, the mind is a mirror which does not reflect things properly now because it's been corrupted. And we need to clear those corruptions away. And so he spoke about the four idols that get in the way of men thinking properly. The kinds of things that are false ideas and prejudices that force us into error when we think. He spoke of the idols of the tribe, the idols of a cave, the idols of the marketplace, and the idols of the theater. However, those words are not very helpful. He meant by the idols of the tribe those things we share in common with the race of humans. The idols of the cave are those prejudices and things that are part of our own individual upbringing and thinking and feeling. The idols of the marketplace are those false ideas we get in our concourse with men because we talk to other people and we pick up their superstitious ideas. And then we have the idols of the theater, which he called the various dogmas of philosophies. See, Bacon here, the beginning of that antipathy toward philosophers like poor Dr. Bahnsen, that says, that's the problem. You guys are just theatrical. You put on all these grandiose, speculative notions, and they're absolutely no good and no use to us. What did he say? Knowledge is power. the importance of science is its utility. And one of the great idols of mankind that gets in the way, you see, are the idols of the theater. The philosophers come along and they entertain us with their speculations, but there's no practical value to it at all. Bacon is to be credited with talking about the influence of prejudice and rationalization in the thinking process. He claimed that Aristotle had corrupted natural philosophy, that is, had corrupted the study of nature by his philosophical speculations, his understanding of logic. And he said that in order to understand the world, we need to use an experimental method. We need the evidence of the senses, as he put it. And he went on to promote in Novum Organum what we now call the inductive method of study. What's of interest, though, if you want to study the history of science, and I can only be brief right now, is that what Bacon described as the inductive method, most people today would consider a rational reconstruction, not really a discussion of the method of science, how one could go about proving something inductively, but rather after Bacon had some conclusions, he went back and, if you will, kind of reconstructed what it would be like to use an inductive method to get to those conclusions. Because if you study it, I mean, his tables of association and distance and all the rest, no scientist could ever, well, I mean, I guess he could in some limited ways, but any, you know, advanced scientific discovery, it would just be beyond human ability to write out all the tables and do all the comparisons and finally draw the conclusions necessary. But though it was a failure and probably a rational reconstruction, that is not a true description of scientific method, nevertheless, Bacon is to be credited because he attempted to reduce to some kind of general description what an inductive method would be like, the scientific approach. Well, there's much that I might comment on. I don't want to take too much of your time. We need to move beyond Bacon and point out that what particularly made possible the scientific revolution was the reducing of the study of nature to mathematical formulas. It was the bringing in of the conviction that qualitative analysis could be reduced to quantitative analysis, where everything could be put in charts and tables and compared mathematically, that made possible the scientific revolution. It is not enough, I want you to learn, it's not enough that men like Francis Bacon or William Gilbert wanted to go out and use their senses. That empirical drive is important to the scientific revolution. But what drove the scientific revolution was the taking of what the senses tell us when we get all our detailed studies and reducing it to mathematical formulas for the sake of testing and the seeing of relationships. And this is illustrated very well in the careers of Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo. You realize that Copernicus, who is known for advancing the notion that the sun is at the center of our solar system and not the earth. Copernicus did this not primarily because he had measured and worked out all of the details. We come to Tycho Brahe. He didn't believe that the sun was at the center of the universe, but what he did is he wrote down extended list of details from observation. And then his student, Kepler, looking at the details, applied a creative mathematical mind to figure out certain anomalies and realized then the simplest explanation is that the sun is at the center rather than having the earth at the center and then all the details accounted for by epicycles, you see, of the planets as they're going around. You should all know this story, so I'm not going to bother to give you the details late in the day here. But you see, what's interesting is it was a mathematical mind, Kepler's, taking the details of a man who didn't even believe that the sun was at the center of the solar system, taking the observational details and trying to find formulas by which to account for things that led him to assert that the sun is at the center of the solar system. Let me give you some dates here. Francis Bacon is 1561 to 1626. William Gilbert, 1544 to 1603. Copernicus was 1475 to 1543. Kepler, 1571 to 1630. And now finally Galileo, before we break for today, 1564 to 1642. Kepler had done a wonderful job of applying mathematical geometric analysis to the data of the census and drew the conclusion, Kepler realized that the orbit of the planets is elliptical, it turns out, rather than circular. If he had been an Aristotelian, of course the orbit of the planets is circular, because that fits in with the philosophical preconception about circles being perfect and the planets being perfect in their orbit necessarily will be circular. Well, Kepler said the facts don't fit that. The formula won't work. But if you use a parabola, then you can find that the details fit. Anyway, this is really wonderful, bringing of math to bear on empirical studies, and what we get is this wonderful scientific revolution. But after Kepler did his mathematical work, that would not convince people. Kepler kept quiet enough, by the way, that he didn't get into a lot of trouble. Galileo, on the other hand, developed what? A telescope. And Galileo said, wait a minute now. When you look through this telescope, the Aristotelian system just doesn't fit the facts as we experience them. And in particular, what was it, the discovery of the moons of Jupiter in Galileo? Anyway, because Galileo campaigned for his heliocentric view of the universe, he ran afoul of the interpreters of the church and the authority of the church. Now I'm going to say real quickly for you, you will pervasively find propaganda against Christianity that tells you in the Galileo affair what you see is how the church and religious superstition gets in the way of scientific advance. People who wouldn't even look in Galileo's telescope so that he could verify what he was saying to them. Well, Galileo did fall afoul of the church. He did not fall afoul of God's word. And what we have to point out to people is that you did have a political struggle between the Romanist church and Galileo, but that's not to say that it's religion or Christianity or the Bible that was the problem for Galileo. It was an interpretation of the Bible that was motivated not by what we would consider legitimate exegesis, but by what? Aristotelian philosophy. When you go to the Bible and read it through Aristotelian eyes, and you come up with these conclusions, and your church has the kind of, you know, dogmatic authority that Rome did, then yeah, we get the Galileo affair. But that is not at all to say that scientific advance, the Galileos of this world, fall, you know, out with Christianity or every individual going to the Bible to interpret it properly. At base, the conflict was between Aristotle and Galileo, and Aristotle's champions in that day happened to be the Roman Catholics. I think that helps you to see the situation in a clearer light than what we usually get in the propaganda against us. Nevertheless, in this natural science period of the Renaissance, which Sahakian sees in its ascendancy from 1600 to 1690, we see the mathematical spirit applied to the empirical spirit with great results. And of course, the greatest of all of these is Sir Isaac Newton. Newton's date, 1642-1727. Any of you who have taken courses in physics, know anything about Western history, of course, know the domineering place of Sir Isaac Newton as someone who demonstrated that this natural world can be reduced to mechanical formulas. And we can understand it, make predictions, and what? Control it. Make useful, make our information about the world useful to us. And so this concludes my discussion of the Renaissance in terms of its cultural characteristics. Let me remind you real quickly what we covered today: the spirit of exploration with its economic and social effects, the rise of money power, the increased volume of money, the decline of the guild, the revival of learning, textual criticism, the Renaissance man and his value with his pride and autonomy, the well-rounded man who is individualistic, who is free. We've looked at the development of a new political approach, which is naturalistic, not supernatural, that is ruthless in the case of Machiavelli, idealistic in the case of the Utopians. And then finally, the new scientific method, bringing a first-hand observational approach in fruitful contact with the mathematical spirit and eventuating in the great advances of a Sir Isaac Newton. When we get back together, I would like to look at the Renaissance again in terms of what Schaeffer teaches you about it. And so let me encourage you over this evening to do your reading in Schaeffer on the Renaissance. Please get chapters 3, 4, and 5 under your belt this evening, and then tomorrow we'll look at the Renaissance and the Reformation and start comparing them with a view to bringing Calvin and Hobbes into conflict eventually. Thanks.